It's Wednesday, February 18th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 137 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 50 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
My name is Pat.
My name is Chris.
Pat, you never played Oregon Trail.
Loser.
What?
I'm taking away
your geek card, man.
I probably played it once or twice. Well, what you would understand is...
Pat, you have dysentery.
I went to school before you all did. When I was in school,
I don't think you went to school before Chris things. Did.
Chris, what age did you play it then, Chris? Because, like I said, in looking at it, I probably played it once or twice, but not all the time.
First time I ever played it was back in fifth grade during a summer school thing, and that probably would have been circa 1980.
Okay. You have to remember that Chris' age is kind of like elf age. He was a toddler back at like 40.
Yeah.
So there's really no telling.
So, yeah, I mean, so you're about 5 years or so behind me, I guess. I would have been in fifth grade around 1984, 85, somewhere around there. But I've seen it once, but I was not as familiar with it as you guys are.
Well, then, Pat, you probably really were more in the wizardry category then, I would imagine, then, because that's your Apple IIe's, you know, or 2C's, I think, maybe sometime around then.
Yeah.
But you had wizardry, didn't you, on the big old 5 1/4 inch?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had that. And actually, some of my first experience with a computer was actually doing the whole basic Hello World programs. We actually did that in programming, turning the screen different colors.
Repeating text. Yeah. 10, go to 20, 20, say hi or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was that.
I taught myself basic from a book, but I don't think they did like that in our school. The most we ever did, and I hardly call this programming, was Logo. And for anyone's not familiar with Logo, it's a drawing program that somebody told me was originally designed to move robots around.
Oh.
But you'd give it instructions like turn right 30 degrees, move forward 20 steps or whatever.
That sounds
and
really familiar.
This would all translate to stuff on your screen. You had a little like triangle called a turtle that you could make draw all kinds of weird patterns if you really kind of got your head around the math that it was using.
I took a Pascal programming class in junior high.
Oh my God.
Does anyone remember Zebop? I think that was its name. There were these little,
Isn't that a teen music star?
No, there are these little tutorial programs that came with Apple IIe's and 2C's that taught you like how to use the keyboard. Because I remember this was all very new at the time. And one of them, I want to say like the one of the little lead characters that was teaching you how to do it was this funky little thing. I think his name was Zebop. I'll see if I can find a picture of it online.
I didn't have Zebop. My dad bought an Apple IIgs, and I think the only thing with that was it had a color screen. I don't even remember.
And it had Keith the Thief.
Yeah, it had Keith the Thief on it, which is a really difficult game, at least for when I was that age. But they had something like that, where it was teaching you how to type, how to do certain keyboard combinations, it was a lot of stuff with a mouse, how to click a mouse and things like that. And it was this Indiana Jones knockoff, and it was a side-scroller.
The natives learned that skill kind of automatically, but go ahead.
They had basically Indiana Jones, although it was not an officially licensed product, was at the top of the screen, and he would start going into a cave at the right. There were different traps, and you had to click on them in different ways, maybe drag a switch or click something and do that. And so you would guide him all the way through the thing. And it wasn't my first video game, but it was my first video game on a computer that wasn't a Nintendo.
Right.
And I remember just playing that over and over again because it was the only real video game that I had. God, that's really sad, though.
Well, it is startling to think of the genesis of computers, because like I said, we all remember that, you know, and a lot of the, you know, people that are younger than us
computers?
Or much younger.
Oh, the genesis of computers Sega Genesis?
No, I'm sorry. Like the sort of the beginning of computer games. We're talking about way back in the beginning here. Like I said, talking about the basic, almost back to the Pong era of games, and God, it was so simple. But at that time, it was like, this is so awesome.
So, Chris, what kind of games did you play on your little abacus that you had when you were?
I had a C64, baby. And I had a few games here and there, you know, your minor 2049er and Galaga. I think I had that as well. But Bard's Tale for the C64, that was the game to have and play.
Except that game was a bitch when you first started it. there was something that was true of all those older RPGs, and I am a big fan of the really old RPGs, but they all had one thing in common, which was they were inordinately hard at first level.
It was back when games were hard.
Yeah, once you ground out that those first couple levels, you were third level, fourth level, fifth level, you were probably okay. But they were just merciless to you at that first level, because, I mean, they did pretty much what D&D does, where you're walking around four hit points and one hit could kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, you've got to get through not just one fight, but like 25 fights before you get to any kind of a level up point or something. Mm. It was brutal.
I never played with Commodore 64. I think I was just 2 or 3 years slightly too young to really get into that.
Well, you probably play the same games, though, because computers back then are like consoles are now. Where if a game came out for one computer, it was typically ported over to at least the Apple II. The IBM at the time would have been like an 8086 or a 286 maybe.
Yeah.
And then the Commodore 64. And most of the games that came out for one came out for the other two. Not always. But I remember going into Babbage's Software, which doesn't exist anymore. I think they
got
consumed by, I think it's GameStop. I don't remember which one.
I don't think they got consumed by GameStop. No. I think they got bought out like three times and then died. And then GameStop moved into all the old Babbage
slots. Well, eventually GameStop harvested the organs. But yes. I remember going into Babbage's Software.
Babbage's had a donor card.
And I would flip the game over. And on the back, it'd have all this description of the game, and then you'd have multiple screenshots, because it's not like a video game for the PS3 and the Xbox 360, where they probably look and play about the same. There'd be radical differences in terms of the entire appearance of the game.
Yeah, maybe they'd use one of their three colors, and then...
Yeah, another one they'd use.
Remember Babbage's hat?
Apple II, now featuring not green.
Not green, amber. Remember amber
switches
on
color.
Screen? Was it Babbage's had two television monitors outside their front sort of display by the, you know, they have a glass window and a doorway, and underneath the glass window, they had two television monitors that ran loops of video games.
Yep.
You know, and I could never, as a little kid, I could never tell. I always thought, is there some guy in back playing this game, or, oh, what's that? And I tried to see if it looped or anything like that. Well, of course it was just a tape or something that they were playing, but yeah, I remember standing there. I'm surprised I never got snatched as a little kid, because my parents would do that. They would let me loose in a video game store, and then they would go shopping or a toy store and stuff.
Well,
my parents
were
awful.
That's
like
a whole other issue, because, same way. You know, that's just the difference of the time, man. That's, you're
totally
talking 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I did the same thing. Like, I would get to run around the mall for an hour. Mom would take me shopping, and we'd say, okay, we're going to meet at the food court at noon.
Right.
I'd be running around by myself, and I was like, I was 10.
Well, it was also a day back when somebody kidnapped a kid. The criminal was the kidnapper, not the parent. So
I have distinct memories of my dad dropping me off to go see Star Wars by myself. And this is back when I was in maybe third, fourth grade. And I remember he let me go see Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla at this dive theater in a bad part of town. And it was just me. It was just me.
Just you and the perverts.
Yeah. It was just me and Herman. Exactly.
Did your dad always have a dejected look on his face when he actually, you know, come to pick you up and you were actually there?
You're still here. Huh?
Did he smell of cheap beer and hookers
and fear?
Yeah, my parents put me on an airplane to Indiana by myself when I was like 8 or 9 years old. And it wasn't like, here's some cab fare, I hope you get a ticket. But it was more like, you know, they walked me right up to the gate. Yeah. You know, they're like, okay, go and find your seat. And I sat there and flew to Indiana. My uncle was waiting for me on the other side. And there was nothing. I don't even know if you can even
do that.
You can.
The airport staff and then the airline staff will escort you.
You have your entourage with you. But did the slightly weathered stewardess then give you like a Tom Collins or a screwdriver while you're in the plane
flight?
Oh,
that would be awesome. I mean, no, that's horrible.
I remember
different times.
I remember I celebrated a birthday on an airplane one time when I went to Hawaii.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah.
A way to celebrate a birthday.
Yeah, we were over the Pacific. I mean, I was a little kid, but we were over the Pacific and flying to Hawaii. And I remember they gave me, the stewardesses came by and different things. They were like, oh, happy birthday.
If you were to have flown the right direction and long enough, you could have celebrated your birthday twice.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. Or if I like was old enough to actually have the math skills to figure that out. But
that's true.
You know, I was not that old. Yeah, they gave me like a beach mat or something like that. I forget. They had something.
And so the lesson learned here is Pat sucks for never having played Oregon Trail.
I know.
No, actually, I did play it, but like I said, when you first brought it up, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about.
This whole thing was brought up because I read on a blog today that they are bringing out Oregon Trail for the iPhone. And I am so pumped about that. I have absolutely wonderful memories of, you know, going into a classroom filled with all those yellowing Apple IIe's and playing that game and dying of dysentery. I absolutely love that. I had like strategies and stuff, like I'm sure every kid did.
And none of them worked.
I don't know, man. I did the banker route where, I mean, that's the quote easy game, but I did the banker route and I spent every single dime I had on bullets and I just shot my way to Oregon.
You know, there was a game that was sort of like this. I forget the exact name of it, but it was drilling for oil.
Really?
It was, that's
the There Will Be Blood game, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. He had a deaf son and everything. It was great. this was back on the old green screens. There was not color, the one I played it on. So it was probably like one of the old Apples or, I'm not sure. But anyway, yeah, it was basically you go out and you prospect for oil and then you take a sounding and everything and then you drill a well and see if you struck oil.
Do you remember what it was called at all?
That's why I was saying I can't remember the name, but I'll have to look it up and see. But that's one of those old games sort of like that. But I think it's not even, I don't think it was even as sophisticated as Oregon Trail, like you're talking about.
Yeah.
I always played the balanced game. I always took whatever the middle option was. And I don't remember, but I didn't quite have your Murder Fest Destiny strategy.
It was cool. It was great. Why did you have to buy meat when you just shot your meat on the way? And I think you could use the meat as clothes, but if you are the bear, the bears and the rabbits
he's
and
wearing
the squirrels,
a meat suit
as clothes.
Meat suit.
But if you couldn't, maybe I bought just the minimalist amount of clothes. But yeah,
it's a jerky jerkin.
Sorry,
that's a bunch of baloney, Pat.
I'm still laughing at shot your meat.
Best game on those old platforms.
I was five, Chris. You're a pervert.
If we're talking about educational games or pseudo-educational games, was In Search of the Most Amazing Thing.
You know, I remember the name. I remember even seeing the box. I think I even played it, but I have no clue what game you're talking about.
Well, the gist of it was it was a fairly multi-tiered, I don't know if I'd quite call it a puzzle game. It was kind of like a puzzle RPG where you were trying to find something called the most amazing thing. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to be like this little rock or something that would grant wishes. I don't remember exactly what it was, but you had to get there and like you'd end up having to get clues along the way. And that could involve like negotiating with aliens or trying to understand their language and appeal to what they want. There was some trading involved. Mm-hmm. Occasionally little monsters would chase you around. Sometimes you'd have to go get food, which would require a little different minigame. There are tons of these little minigames. But one of the things that I really loved about it, and this is because from a young age, I was headed to an RPG hobby, even though, before I knew what an RPG was. The game had a fairly intense backstory that if you read the manual, it talked about all these things that occurred.
Did it actually have a fairly intense backstory? Or was this like a playground where,
all right, well,
it was five pages, but you remember it as a volume.
Let me put it to you this way. It was probably just a couple pages.
Yeah.
But what they had there, if I was to put it in front of you right now and say, design a tabletop RPG out of this, it'd be a goldmine of information. Hmm. That it's only a couple little hooks, but these hooks provide
you're a guy. You're looking for things. You're looking for most amazing thing.
For example, the thing that you
sounds
were
like
in.
D&D.
The thing that you were in had multiple modes of transportation. It was called something. I don't remember what. But it was like the C in the series. And it talks about how your grandfather, somebody had developed this, but there was like an A vehicle and a B vehicle. And they were actually different vehicles that had completely different purposes, but he'd had to scrap them for some reason. Just stuff like that. I don't remember all the details. This was a long time ago.
Yeah, like I said, I totally remember seeing the game and stuff, and I'm sure I even played it. I just don't remember a thing about it. I might have to go track down an emulator and check it out.
So some guys were talking on our forum today, kind of got me thinking. I've actually thought about this before, but they brought this point back up, which is right now with the economy so far down, a lot of forms of entertainment are really suffering. Like we just came back from a pizza place, and normally when we go out there on a Tuesday night before recording, that place, I mean, it's not packed with people standing in the streets, but it's pretty busy. There's most of the tables are
there's
taken.
More there's, than us.
Yeah, it's not just us in there.
Which is what it was tonight. I mean, it was like an old man and his grandson and then us. It was hilarious. They had Family Guy blaring on all the TVs around there, and he was like, "This is just disgusting. This is awful." And then I looked over at him, and he's looking right at me. And I'm like, it's one of those uncomfortable things. Is he telling? I'm laughing at it. Is he accusing me? Is he telling me that this is disgusting, or is he just some crazy old man? And it's like, but it's Family Guy. It's funny.
See, my thing was is that the television that I was actually watching was right behind him. Uh-huh. So I was sitting there pointing at him, like looking over his head. So I think it was like wigging him out because why is this guy looking at me? I'm like, I'm watching the TV.
You'd say, I'm not looking at you, old man. I'm looking at your grandson.
Hey, now.
And I want to show him the most amazing thing.
Wow.
So, but the point that they were bringing up is that one of the forms of entertainment, at least by some estimations that's up right now, and it's hard to tell because nobody's terribly forthcoming with their numbers, but by some estimations, the sale of RPGs may be a little up right now because of the fact that RPGs offer one thing with two parts, which is cost-effective escapism. That if you take an RPG book, of course, this is great escapism. You don't have to deal with reality. You're dealing with anything but reality. And if you look at it hour per hour, if you go out and spend $30 on an RPG book, you're probably going to get a lot more than 30 hours entertainment out of it. So you are talking about some number of pennies for each hour of entertainment you're going to get from this product. I mean, how many hundreds or thousands of hours do most people listening to this have they gotten out of their favorite game?
Can we not go and pick up a game off of your shelf that we bought 15 years ago?
Yeah.
And just have a really great game? Yeah.
Related to that, too, is the fact that, you know, you're at home. And or you think to yourself you have to stay at home, you know, because you can't really go out and spend that money. But yet you still have that. You still want to do something instead of, you know, just vegetate in front of the TV. So what are you going to do? You might as well just stay home. You need some activity to keep you going at home.
I think the only form of entertainment that I can come up with that comes close, unless we count things that are completely free, or at least free once you've paid the entry cost, like let's say television, would be something like a novel. But if you look at what you spend dollars per hour on the typical video game, which probably 20 or 40 hours, then it's beaten and you're done. Maybe on a multiplayer game, you'll squeeze a lot more out of it. But generally speaking, you're going to play it through once and be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably spending a little, you know, $1.25, $2 an hour to get through the game. And from what I understand in Europe, it just goes up from there. But you go see a movie. They'll say you spend $10 to get in the door for 2 hours of entertainment. You're spending $5 an hour. And that's if you don't buy snacks. That's not counting the gas it costs you to get there.
Yeah. Most people can't go by themselves.
Right. So you take a couple, you go buy an RPG book. Once again, I mean, you're talking just pennies on the hour.
Oh, yeah. And like you said, it's basically unlimited. It's true. It truly is like it's a choose your own adventure book with infinite possibilities. You can always play it again. I love Choose Your Own Adventure. Of course, they were awesome.
Loved them.
You can play it again. It's always something different. So yeah, it is a great, it is very cost effective. That's why more people should role play.
Yeah. This one guy at work, his hobby is pets. I mean, I guess it's not a hobby, but you know, he's really into his dog and his macaw or whatever bird he has. But his other two hobbies, the ones that he actively participates in and spends money on, loves going to sports games. Loves driving around a Harley Davidson. I mean, that's not exactly cost effective.
Well, neither is his pets. If he has a macaw, that's like a between $5,000 and $25,000 bird.
But his macaw chased off a robber. He had his house. He lives in a not so great part of town here in St. Louis. And somebody broke into his house through his basement and was working his way upstairs. They have the macaw upstairs in their bedroom, and whenever anybody walks up, because every time him and his wife walk up the stairs, they're like, "Hey, how's it going?" talking to the bird, and the bird's like, "Hey, how's it going? Who's that? How's it going? Hi, who's there?" And so the thief made it all the way upstairs, and then somebody was like, "Who's that? Who's there? Hello?" Then the thief ran for it, didn't take a single thing. That's awesome. I think that bird's paid for itself.
Okay.
Chad, you have to talk like that the rest of the episode.
Hello? What are you talking about?
Between that and the meat suit.
Ah, yes.
Somebody tell you guys about a problem I'm having with my current gaming group.
What kind of problem?
Sorry.
Oh. Dysfunction. I knew that'd get him.
Every time I talk, they parrot me.
Birds of a feather.
My whole game feels like a parody. So my problem is shepherding my players. I'm sure a lot of GMs have this problem where you've got a great game and your players won't stop jacking around and stay on subject.
Don't look at me, man. I told you, get control of your game twice. Yeah,
in between jokes you were cracking and...
get control of your game.
This is like the Beltway sniper being like, somebody really needs to get crime under control.
That's right. I was making a point.
See, if the problem here, I think this is where you got to know your group, because sometimes when your players do that, they're trying to tell you something. Which is the...
They need to be burped? What?
or maybe need to be changed.
You're not giving them enough attention? They need a hug?
Possibly.
Yeah.
They're bored. They're maybe bored at that moment in the game because they're not getting enough attention. The spotlight's been on somebody else too much. Maybe they're bored or frustrated with the game in general, so they're finding other ways to entertain themselves. But then there are games like this one, where I know for a fact it's going really well, because just the feedback has been unanimously...
No, we're just lying to you.
Okay.
We really hate this game. The deep characters, the great role-playing, the complex plot, the action, the all of us getting into it, total crap. Absolute snow job to make you feel better.
I feel like John Bon Jovi.
You kind of look like him.
Thank you, I guess.
Wow.
Wow, I look washed up. So, but there are a few tactics I've found for shepherding your players.
Yes.
Here are some of them that I'm going to suggest, and I'm curious what you guys have found to help you deal with this. Chad, I know you've had to deal with this. Mm-hmm. I'm generally not a sore, so it's simply because being someone who GMs so much, I'm sympathetic to these pains. But I've seen you suffer this with some other groups and some other people. Chris, you seem to be like just on the zany Twilight Zone Wild West role-playing with sandwich boards and
speaking of that, I have mechs
and whatever else it is you have. So
I don't mean to derail your topic here, but I have my banner, or as you would call it, my sandwich board. I have it with me.
Put it on, take a picture of it.
It's right over there.
Well, put it on, take a picture of it.
All right, well, I'd have to get out the headphones. Please ask me your question first, and I'll give you my BS answer.
So,
by the way, wait, you know, in your particular case, you just mentioned right now, that you were dealing with right now, I would actually put forth the fact that I think it's seasonal related. You guys, right now, in your geographic area, you're kind of going through spring, essentially, aren't you? I mean, temperatures are rising, snow's pretty much gone.
Indian summer, I wouldn't call it spring, it's an Indian summer.
Missouri and St. Louis is like that. We're kind of on this border edge, so this week has been absolutely beautiful, gotten up into 70s, and it will probably snow next week.
But see, I think that, though, has a lot to do with it. It's a seasonal thing. There are times, because... Mm-hmm. You got immersive role-playing. You got players who are enjoying what they're doing. You got a good plot. You got fun combats. You got all this great stuff. But yet, at the same time, they're all just kind of... And a lot of times, it's seasonal. It's just seasonal related. The weather's doing good, and they're feeling good. They want to get outside and, you know...
You know what I see it as? Now, this isn't the rule. It's not all the time. I see it as sometimes the players don't have a lot of social interactions in that week. Perchance that they just didn't get to see each other or see a lot of their other friends. Perhaps they've been really busy at work and really busy like around the house or something like that. And then they get out and they want a game. We all want a game, but they also need that human social interaction. And so like that path of least social resistance, they start cracking jokes and being funny and, you know, getting their social fix in.
Well, that's really the first piece of advice I can give. When your gaming group starts doing this, if you've taken stock of what do they really think of the game as a whole and how do they really feel right this moment? So, you know, the issues, they're not bored with the game. They're not frustrated with the plot point. They're not just blowing off steam. They really are enjoying the game. The next thing I would say is it's not personal. Don't get mad. They're just having fun.
Yeah. Let people have fun. Like, that's my piece of advice there is that if everything checks out, everything's fine with the game and you just perceive that it's them being social as a game master, kind of let that slide for a little bit, you know, not all night. Don't let it ruin the game or anything like that. And not if it's necessarily in the middle of the game, but when everybody sits down, they have all their dice and sodas and there's a lot of table talk and joking around stuff. give them a half hour. Join in yourself, you know, let everybody kind of get relaxed and calm down and happy to see each other and get all the jokes out of their system.
That's exactly what I have some other suggestions here, but the one I found that works for this group, I just let everyone work it out of their system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't say anything. I just kind of sit there and let it ride. Let everybody work it out until at some point I'll say, well, you know, it's kind of getting late and Pat's going to have to leave in a couple hours. And then everyone starts panicking. It's like, oh, crap, we're not going to get any gaming in tonight. And then they're more focused than I am.
Pat's wife is going to start calling here any minute asking if he's at the strip clubs or not.
And I do thank you guys for covering for me all this time.
Yeah, no problem.
We'll catch you up on the game at some point.
That's good. I'm interested in the cliff notes that I've actually read up to this point. Actually, you know, as far as you say on that, I think you're being a little bit too generous. I think really our problem is that we have the attention span of a gnat on sugar water, but,
and I do love sugar water.
It is good stuff. I would say just my own opinion would be that I am okay with actually maybe being more shepherd, like you said, back into the game. Like, I would not be in the least bit offended if you were to, you know, sort of take the reins and say, all right, you know, hey, that was funny, but let's get back down to gaming.
Yeah.
Now, again, that's personal. Maybe Chad or Dave or somebody else would not really want that, but
no, I'm
fine with it because I love joking around and I will joke around with the best of you, but I'm there to game and I am always looking forward to, let's get back to the story.
And this is a huge sort of sea change for me. In that I've been noticing the past several games of, you know, I do notice that you kind of let us out and let us, you know, just socialize and stuff and saying, hey, my game, which is cool. It's like I just said, I think that's what you should do. But I have been noticing that I am almost usually the first one who's like, okay, can we, or I whip out my phone and I'm like, I'm just going to play my game here until we get on topic. And which is very, very weird because the way I used to play, especially when I was a teenager, I was the worst offender, you know, even during the serious times. I can't even imagine what it would be like to game with myself 15 years ago. How did you do it, Dan? I would have just slapped myself silly.
What was the alternative? Everyone else in the group was just as bad.
Yeah.
I mean, we've mentioned on the show before, and it was not a joke. During our very first RPG campaign, that fastest Star Trek game way back on his 1988, would do initiative by basically whoever I could hear first.
Right.
Not who spoke first, but whoever gave an action which I could understand, which meant whoever was yelling the loudest. Mm-hmm. That was how we did initiative.
It was like a room full of...
That's insane.
So crazy teenage boys just all hopped up on caffeine, going berserk.
So my second suggestion,
it is fun times,
which Chad, you just kind of mentioned yourself in this role, is you find some way to crack the whip. You're not an ass. You just kind of say, do whatever your grandma would do. She knows how to apply the pressure with just one statement. Guys, I worked really hard on this and it really sucked if all that work went to waste. The guilt trip.
Yeah. Or the guilt by proxy. You know, Pat can't stay out all night.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or even just the little nag. Guys, can we please get back on topic?
Yeah.
The third one, I was actually considering this. I haven't started with you guys yet. It's you create a floating threat. And here's how it works. You can make a little game out of it. It's like a mini game unto itself. So you as a game master, you have to understand that you're playing multiple games. There's the RPG you're running. And then there's kind of the mini game of life that you are playing at the head of that table. And if you're not playing that game and enjoying it, you're not cut out to be a game master. You're just going to get pissed off. But here's how this works. Let's say you have four people at the table, like I do. Come up with enough stuff for about half of them. If you got five, go ahead and round up. So if you had five people, you're going to take three of these. And it'll be little tokens. And these tokens might represent something different in every game. For example, if you're playing Savage Worlds, they might represent the poker chips that you get for rerolls. If in Skies of Glass, it's the bullets, little plastic bullets. If it's D&D, they might represent like a 10% XP bonus. It could be whatever. Who knows what? But what you do is you basically organize this so half the party has these. But every time somebody's jacking around, you move it away from them to somebody who's not jacking around. And at the end of the game, whoever has the tokens can cash them out for whatever it is they are.
Nice. See that?
I don't know if I agree with that one completely.
Because you're a bitch.
That's right.
Well, maybe. I don't know. That seems...
condescending?
I don't know. Seems what?
It seems condescending.
Well, I don't know if condescending is so much, but it...
manipulative, maybe.
Manipulative, treating them like children, but I guess in certain cases, maybe they are. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying I wouldn't do it, because it certainly has merit, and I think, you know, in-game rewards like that sometimes are a good thing. I don't know. I don't know if I'm 100% behind you on that one. I might just be a little bit off to the side behind you.
I think you know I'm right. You just hate the principle of it.
Well, that's always been true.
I guess the other way I would couch this is to say that I'm suggesting this as a workable plan. There's a lot of things on Fear the Boot we suggest as workable plans. That doesn't mean they're a good idea.
Right.
And this certainly being a condescending ask to your players if they're going to take it that way and not take it in good humor. And, you know, it's kind of the, I guess, like the whole thing for Full Metal Jacket. You screwed up, so we're not going to punish you. We're going to punish everyone else in the platoon. And it's effective, but is it really right? I don't know. But Chad, like I said, I know you've had to deal with this. What do you do?
Well, usually I just have something happen. I let the players kind of go for a bit, and I joke right around with them and stuff. And then
you demand their attention again.
Well, I do one of two things. I stop talking and I get real quiet and I don't say a word and I just sit there. And then I just try and get this look on my face, this sort of smirk. I kind of like narrow my eyes and I look from player to player. And then usually someone in the group will kind of get the hint and they'll be like, uh-oh, what's he thinking? Uh-oh. And then they start thinking, well, he's thinking about something with the game. And then they start thinking about the game. And it's this sort of domino effect. If that doesn't work, I might like roll some dice over nothing. I'm not rolling for anything. And I'm not just rolling a whole bunch, you know, just shoot a couple of dice and just kind of wait. And then people kind of fall in line, or I start making threats. You know, I start like having things happen and I start saying blah, blah, blah. I really don't do the threat thing very much, to be honest with you. What I usually do is, because I'm actually a very loud person, Big Shock.
No.
Yeah. I have a very loud sort of projecting voice, and I kind of like raise my hands up and, you know, spray my fingers out, and I'm like, all right, listen up.
Did you say spray your fingers out?
Spray.
I think you meant splay.
Splay. No, I spray my
leprosy and all, man. Just like, blam.
Or he shoots his cuffs. That's
somebody got a, like, a finger right in the eye.
Kick
one time.
Ass.
Yeah. And then I just go and put him back in. But anyway, I go, okay, this is what's happening. And then I just start in. And usually people kind of fall in line with that. So, yes, quiet, squinty eyes, and then yelling.
Let's move on to something else. Ending a campaign.
Yes.
Now, we're assuming that this is under good circumstances, all right? There's another topic we might hit in a later show that some people have asked us to talk about, which is ending a campaign when something's wrong. Basically, walking away from the table because the group's falling apart, because real life's distracting you, whatever. And we might talk about that later. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a downer subject. So let's talk about a positive one. Ending the campaign. So game's been going on a while. You're thinking maybe it's about time to move on to something else. Or maybe you're not. Maybe things are going great. But you decide that you want to take the story out on a high note instead of a low note. You want to quit while you're ahead.
Well, and we're also assuming that the game doesn't have a hard ending. Like, you wrote a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the end is to kill the dragon and rescue the princess, and you've killed the dragon and rescued for, well, obviously the game.
Well, that's where it's going to end. Yeah. If you have a plot ending,
yeah,
that's where it's going to end. But, you know, something I have seen in some games I've been in is the game does have an ending, but it's not a plot ending so much as an imagined, I don't know, for lack of a better way to describe it, an archetypical ending.
Yeah.
For example, Chad, there was a game that we were playing. It was kind of a generic sci-fi setting several years ago, where at the start of the game, you said to the game master, this is how I want my character to go out. Mm-hmm. Because you'd kind of figured out the arc of his existence.
Yeah.
That this is where he started, this is how he's going to develop, and this is how you wanted him to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so you did not
What game was this?
This would have been when you were playing the guy who was the pit fighter, and you kind of wanted him to go out in this blaze of glory. I don't remember all the details, and even if I did, I wouldn't recount a gaming story for the sake of the listeners. But
it was one of my characters, so it's a fantastic gaming story.
Best ever, right?
Yes, yes. But they all are.
The point being that nonetheless, you said to the game master, this is how I want this character to go out. And I remember, though, while it wasn't quite as specific, that all of us kind of had this sense. We were really into the characters, and we had this sense of where they wanted them to go. And so there was this kind of imagined ending.
Right.
And once the game hit a point where that had occurred in the natural progress of the game, it was over.
Right.
So it was planned, but it was not planned in the plot sense of mm-hmm. once the dragon's dead, there's nothing more to do, or there's nothing more meaningful yeah. to do.
Well, I find that's a theme in a lot of the type of games I run. You have these characters, and they tend to sometimes live normal lives, or within the framework of the world, they are considered normal, or maybe above normal, but the game is them going on this grand adventure. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they, when they are finished with this adventure, when they kill the bad guy or save the maiden or do whatever that story is, be it stereotypical or something interesting and deep, it doesn't mean that the characters, the players, or the game master wants to follow the story of them afterwards, of them leading a normal life. You know, I think that you could do some game with that a little bit. I think you could do a whole campaign of like where you start the game after the big adventure and it's like these characters deal with the aftermath of it. And that's all fine. But generally speaking, it's kind of like why I like memoirs as opposed to biographies, because in a person's life, they may do some really great things. They may do multiple great things, but they're not doing great things from the moment they're born all the way through their entire life until the moment they die. Right. And that's why I like memoir so much. It gives a little bit of stuff on the beginning of their life and a little bit of stuff afterwards, but it focuses on the cool thing that they did. And to me, that's what I like about a role-playing game. It's that you have these characters who aren't necessarily saving the world every moment of their life. It's like that's their normal thing. Because the way I tell a story, that means you're not exceptional. That means you're not different. That means you're not interesting. Because that is, you are a hero, and you do that normally. And saving the world, that's what you do before breakfast. And that, to me, that's so boring. It's why I don't like, cape superheroes.
Oh, right. And I realize everyone's going to be different. In this
sure.
Regard.
And there are,
for example,
it's a total genre.
I enjoy full biographies because I like seeing the context of why these people did these things.
Sure.
But here's the thing that I would take away from that is I think one of the first cues you have to look for when it's time to end a campaign is not when there's no more story to tell, because there's always more story to tell, unless the whole party is dead. Mm-hmm. And even then, the world still goes on. You can pick up with their friends or their kids sure. or whatever, the guy who just happened to stumble into the situation. But when there's no more story left that you want to tell,
right,
and or the players want to participate in. So even though there may be 100 more things going on and 100 loose ends to wrap up, if everyone's like, you know what, the series is kind of running out of steam, then it's time to shut mm-hmm. it down. And this is something you as a game master are uniquely positioned to tell, because a lot of times, even when a game is at its height and everyone's really pumped for it and wants more, but you know deep in your heart, there's not a whole lot left to do. And if we keep going, this is just jumping the shark. Then you've got to say, let's end here on a high note.
Yeah.
And
you say that, you know, the game master's in a unique position to realize that, which I agree with. But I think, too, at the same time, is that sometimes I think the game master can be somewhat, or the players maybe in a certain sense are somewhat blind to everything the game master has in store. I mean, you may be at this certain high point and the players might think, you know, this actually isn't a bad place to call it quits. And if they kind of get that in their head, you got to be really careful about that, because the GM might be thinking, hey, there's really cool stuff down the road, but doesn't want to necessarily say that. How do you overcome that if you've got essentially two competing, you know, beliefs?
This is an extremely old struggle in any form of storytelling. Of the story you're trying to tell versus the story they're hearing. A great example of this is when I was reading the book Shogun, which is a great book, mentioned it many times. But
yes,
when I was reading Shogun,
did I get you to read that, or did you read
it? I've had it for years. Yeah. I think you might have been a motivating factor, but it's been all.
Because I really
just
love
the phone book size of it intimidated me
sure.
for so long.
Totally.
But as I'm reading that, the story that James Clavell is telling mm-hmm. is one about the people. It's about the intrigue. It's about the maneuvering. It's a very character-driven story. It's yes. not a plot-driven story. And I'd love to do a whole show at some point here on the differences between character, plot, and setting-driven stories. But this was a character-driven story. The story I wanted to hear, I love the story he was telling, but the story I wanted to hear was about this coming battle between the two guys struggling to become shogun and how one of them was going to use these guns he'd gotten mm-hmm. a hold of and all these different strategies they developed. And that story's never told.
No, it's not.
When the book ends, it ends in the lead up to that battle. And I think there's a really brief epilogue.
Yeah.
But you never hear him write out this battle, which the whole book is leading up to. Because you know what? He's trying to tell a different story than the one I think I'm reading at that point.
Right.
And now I think the great thing about role-playing games is if you realize that and you're listening to your group enough to see that, then you can change that. Mm. You can say, wow, I wanted to tell the story about one particular thing. I wanted to tell a story about court intrigue, but they're really more interested in the war that's going on. Then you can change the story.
Yeah.
And you can now say, okay, we're going to end it when the war is over, not when the court intrigue is basically resolved.
Right.
How do you know if you've reached that point? Because it's not always necessarily maybe going to end on the highest of high points in regards to, you know, something. I mean, say, for example, you have not a TPK, but maybe you have a three-quarter party kill because of some battle. Do you end it there? I mean, what kind of signs really do you need to look for that give you that signal that it is time to end it?
Yeah. Most of the party's dead.
Well, I mean, that's an obvious one.
None of the players want their characters to necessarily be dead. Right, Chris, and you end the campaign? What a downer.
Let me give you some metagame things to look for here. Because I think some of it may be in-game stuff. But I think a lot of that just comes from experience. For example, if you as a game master know that you don't have any inspiration for a story beyond this, and as a result, or you know the things that you would have to tell really wouldn't interest your players. Or maybe they've just gotten done saving the world, and you know you really can't one-up that. You can't make something that's more epic than what they just did, and so you have to quit here so the playground doesn't seem smaller and smaller and smaller with each passing swing. But some of the metagame things I'd look at is, for example, how often are your players talking about different game ideas?
Yeah.
You know what would be great?
That's the big one.
After this, we ought to play Star Wars, and here's the kind of character I'm going to make.
Right.
And the more detail starts getting added into this, the more you can be pretty sure their attention's wandering from this game.
I think you hit it right there. When a person starts thinking about another character, they're not thinking as much about their own character. And I think that's a really big indicator. Maybe not that they like or dislike the campaign, but maybe some other fancy has caught their attention now.
I'd also look at out-of-game conversations, not just whether it's about another game, but how much are they even still talking about this game?
Right.
And how are they talking about the game? Do they have the sense that, wow, I want to do this, explore here, explore there? Or has conversation pretty much just come down to, I can't wait until I get into Baron von Badass's castle and fight him?
I would say attendance also could be a contributing factor in that sense. You know, if the players themselves don't show up and their excuses maybe necessarily aren't that great.
Well, I think with that, you're starting to look into, you know, there's a problem with your campaign. And really, I think we're kind of talking here about, like, the campaign is fine. There's nothing wrong with the game.
Or at least it was fine.
Well, I want to look at, though, there's nothing wrong with the game. There's nothing wrong with the players. But how does a game master, where everything's going fine, how do you know it's timed in? I mean, I think that's one of the challenges we have here with this topic. It's an individual thing. It's an individual situation with an individual game and your players and you and how you want to do it. And it's almost impossible for us to say, well, you end a game on A, B, or C situations. Well, it doesn't play like that. You have a lot of forces going into it, too. Like, you may want to be wrapping up a campaign, but your players might want to keep it going. I think one of the things you can do in that is wrap up your story within the campaign and then see if one of the other players wants to run the campaign. And then their character becomes an NPC and you build another character. You are a player.
There is a situation you can run into where the game master wants to end it. You've reached that point where he feels that it should be ended, but the players, they desperately want to keep it going. And I think in the example you gave where turning it over to somebody else, I think you run the risk, though, and you got to be really careful with that because
you're playing in someone else's playground.
You're playing in someone else's world, but if everyone had a really good time with you as game master, and then suddenly somebody else takes over, because everyone has different styles, they may not be received in the same way, and then it may end up becoming a negative at that point.
Yeah. Something I would urge people not to do is keep a game going out of guilt or out of tradition.
Yeah.
That, oh, we've been doing this for the past 2 years, and I'd really hate to kill this and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm sure some people can come back and say, well, wait a minute. We did do that. We pushed through a rough time. We weren't that into it. And a great game occurred on the other side. And maybe that will happen. So I guess I would be reticent to kind of throw my advice in the opposite extreme and say the first difficulty or first down point, sure, kill the game. But if you have a sense that this game is just becoming drudgery in a way that is not likely to correct itself, yeah, very soon, folks, this is your hobby. This is your entertainment. Yeah. You do not owe it anything. Switch games, for heaven's sake. Yeah. I mean,
change up the lineup, change up players, change right up the game, you know, switch things around. Maybe have someone else GM for a while.
Another bit of suggestion I can give is to create multiple endings for your game. And I don't mean alternate endings. I mean multiple ending points. For example, when you're writing the overall plot arc, you might want to write it so that, okay, when they get to this point and defeat this one villain, then the game could end there. But if everyone's really into it, then here's another arc that goes through what happens to society in the power vacuum that guy created by killing off all the kingdoms or whatever happens. And so you have this way of ending the game at multiple points. This was really easy if I run a game like Star Trek, because I run it episodically. Mm-hmm. Here's a mission. And there might be some kind of a feeling of anthology to the whole thing, because there are elements, yeah, that carry over, characters that keep recurring. But at any given moment, when you take care of that last bit of mystery and go back to the ship, we could stop the campaign right there.
That's one thing that I always try and do. I always try to do it in story arcs, where we go and there's a climax of the story, and then there's the aftermath, and then the story ends. But if I want to keep going and the players want to keep going, they can. We can do another story arc off of that. Well, and here's a question for you guys. If one party or another wants something different, basically, if one party wants something different than the other party, if the game master is done and ready to end it, but the players demand that it keeps going and demands that he runs the game, or vice versa, the players are like, not saying that the campaign was bad again, but saying that we really had fun with this campaign. We want to see the ending of it. We want to see the resolution and then move on. And the game master is like, no, this is my baby. I have more to tell. What do you do in that situation? Who should win out? Because obviously you can't do it democratically.
I'd say whoever. I mean, if there's just one guy who's being an ass, ignore him and push on.
Yeah.
But if there's a significant portion of the group, either multiple players or the GM, because the GM is 50% of the voting block right there, maybe 75%. Because guess what? No matter how into it the players are, if the GM's not, the game is going to suck eventually.
And that's why I would say I'd vote for the GM in this case, if in your example, Chad, because, yeah, for your exact reasons, Dan, if he doesn't really want to do it and if his heart's not into it.
Chad's example is the other way around, though. What if the GM is and the players aren't?
Well, I had both examples.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Yeah. All right, well, the point, if in the example where the GM's not into it, definitely you're done. If the GM is and the players aren't, I'd say the same thing. You're done.
I agree. I wanted to say that. And it is, you're talking about the majority. If the majority of the players or the GM are, you've got to just move on, because it's going to suffer either way. So, but it may be one of those things where you can just leave it for a time and come back. I mean, you know, somebody's in a rut, either be it the players or the GM, and maybe the GM, hey, you know, needs to play. He's like, I want to play instead of be running for a while. So switch over, do something else, and then maybe you can come back to it. Maybe not, but, you know, hopefully if it's one of those where it's not that something was wrong, like you're saying, that's another topic, and it was just a rut, I think you can go step away from it and then come back. Mm-hmm. But I definitely think that you should, yeah, if you've got a major problem, if you've got a majority of the players that are having issues, then you've got to stop.
Right.
You know what I'd like to talk about next? Something I've actually not heard covered on any other podcast, blog,
or forum. Do you listen to any other podcasts?
I do. Today, which D&D edition is the best?
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to vomit on you.
So, thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Mwah!
Meat suit.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com.